Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Foxes in the Hen House. Our presenter is Bill Lennon. Session number LEBI 2006-1. Let's listen in.
Anyway, I do a lot of these kinds of workshops, and I would like... It's always a little difficult to say this part because then it kind of points up if anybody gets up to go to the bathroom, are they having some kind of particular problem? But I just think that it's really important to say that since we know that statistically, 35% of all the females in America have been sexually assaulted by the time they're 18. And probably 1 in 10 boys. Now, the data on boys is a little more difficult because there's so much shame around even saying something happened to you, and it's more difficult for boys to acknowledge that they've had that problem. So that's probably a pretty low figure, although I would guess 35% for females may be low also. But so whenever we have a workshop like this, it has the potential to raise some issues for people personally or for your own daughter or somebody. And so I don't know how to exactly do that, but it's important that you take care of yourself. If it gets into some stuff that's uncomfortable, get up and walk out, ask for some help. Bree here is a therapist and works with me, and she works with me in a lot of ways. She's also my wife. Talk later about some things, because that happens. Probably the most common way it happens is that people get angry, and often will get angry at me, and small group is a little harder. When I've got 50 people or 100 people, sometimes there's just a real lot of anger that comes charging up, and you know, that's really understandable because it's so uncomfortable to deal with some of these issues. So however we can do this, I'm just saying it's more important to take care of yourself than it is to get the information. How big is the problem? To increase awareness is what I want to talk about today, and then tomorrow we'll talk about actually what child molesters tell us, and then Friday, how can we be safe and what can we do? And obviously, we'll mishmash that, so I'm going to go back and forth with some of that. And my own background is in working with this. Oh, let me say this also, that I'm not an apologist for child molesters. I'm not trying to say in any way that it's okay to molest kids. I'm not in any way saying that when I develop a theme that it's a disease entity. And it's in some cases, it's not just a case of somebody wanting to do something to someone else. And that can get a little bit confusing. This workshop is to give data and to raise questions. But remember that what my goal here is to explain but not excuse. There isn't any excuse. I mean, there just isn't. Flat end of report. And in working with child molesters, the thing that we find is extraordinarily important for us to remember is that the work that we do is really geared toward helping the next child not to be molested. Because sometimes folks we work with are difficult to work with. Either they're a pain in the neck or somewhere else, or they're just not... behavior just is so uncomfortable for some of us. But the work has to be, but I'm doing this because if we do it effectively, then the next one down the line is not going to be hurt. So that's really why we do this work. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. 10% of the helping professionals cross sexual lines. That every piece of research, sometimes it dips as low as 8, but it's just a fact that we have to deal with, like the example you gave a moment ago about someone in the pastor in the congregation. And I'm not picking on pastors any more than school teachers or psychologists or nurses or anybody else, it tends to run about 10% across some kind of sexual boundary. And about, and this gets a little mushy, but 2-3% that crossing is with children. So I've been working in the field since 1978, and I backed into it. I don't know that I would have. We have a marriage, child, and family practice, and we do a lot of other things too, and work with normal neurotics like you and me, and you know, people come in for test anxiety and lots of different things that don't have anything to do with sex, because we've got, I think, 9 clinicians at our shop. And I think it's really important that you don't work with sex in everything you do. You know, you get to do some other stuff too, and because this is tough work. And I also think you can get jaded, and that's so important not to get too jaded there. But there was a friend of mine who was working in a program that was working with sex offenders that were coming out of an inpatient treatment program at Western State Hospital, which was a lockup ward. And the people that were working with them, welcome back to the party. We've had some good conversations before. So in their organization, the director of the organization was being sexual with several of the clients, of all things, that they were working with me. So that thing blew up, so Tim came and said, a friend of mine who was a counselor, can I hang my shop, my hat in your shop? And so I said, sure, and he did. And since I was the clinical director and the owner, I had to learn about what to do with this sex offender stuff, because it was pretty new to me. And I do a lot of court work, and it's interesting to me, because in the 70s, when I would get in court, they'd always ask, what's your training? Well, there wasn't any. I mean, it's OJT. We're learning this as we go. I mean, you could read some books, but there just wasn't a whole lot in the 70s that we knew what to work with. We worked with 309 families when I lived in Tacoma, and then moved up to Bellevue, and it's been hundreds and hundreds more since then. And it's one part of our practice. It's not all of what we do. I'm also...
So you're in the Bellevue area now?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the reasons we're here, and I'll just put this in, is we're in Spokane, and we're getting dumbed down. Every sex offender that's coming out of the prison is being dumped in downtown Spokane.
That's
and I worked
scary.
In the schools. Oh, it's terrible scary.
Mm-hmm.
On the news all the time, pictures all the time.
Sure. Well, I know that one. And there are, in our state, there are 18,000 registered sex offenders, and about 6,000 out of them, nobody knows where they are. I mean, there are 12,000 of them, they know where they are. The other 6,000, they're out somewhere. The ones that are getting dumped, at least they know where they are. It's really difficult. 2-3% of the priests molest children. 2-3% of across the board molest children. And we'll talk more today about children, but the thing that we do as best we can is we detect and then we see the danger and then we disengage, and there's often a lot of disgrace there, and understandably so, because it's really pretty scary. One of the themes that I was listening to the racial issues yesterday, I attended Paul's workshop, or at times look at other disenfranchised homeless people or different folks and think, what does it do to us inside who profess to be Christians but get so frightened of the population that we're dealing with that we say, go away no matter what? And I'm not even going to try to pretend that I don't have a lot of those reactions. Then I wonder, what does that do to us? Because our first thing is to be frightened and say, I want you to go away because I wish you weren't a part of what we're having to deal with. What I said earlier about often when people elicit their own reactions, and quite often folks get pretty angry at me, I'm sure it's because of some of the things I say is, for instance, in our state, I'm on a committee to find homes for sex offenders to live in, because our belief, those of us that are on committees like that, and I'm on a state committee to evaluate sex offender treaters, the ethical performances of people that are doing the treating, and that happens to be a state committee I'm on, but the people in Wallingford, out of Seattle, just got so outraged because we were going to open a home in Wallingford, and the Wallingford folks said, no, we don't want a home in Wallingford. It's okay to have a home, we don't want one here. And the logic that we were using is, but this doesn't make any difference, and I really understand it doesn't make any difference. In the Wallingford area, there were 50 sex offenders living in the Wallingford area already. And the Wallingford folks didn't know that, but they were living in the area. 50 people in about a 10-mile square area, there were 50 sex offenders. What we said was if we put a home there, it was a Christian organization called Faith Transitions that are trying to buy a home and put it there. There'll be 6 sex offenders, and there'll be a corrections officer visiting there probably twice a day. It'll probably be the safest place that you can find. Well, that's fine, but no, in some other community, we don't want it. And I really understand that. It just really creates a huge problem for that. But my logic here, if it's logic or illogic, is that it's like the lepers in biblical times. You know, they were pretty scary people. And if you hung out with the lepers, you got leprosy, so you didn't want to be touched. So you stuck them way off in a corner somewhere, and they didn't have much in the way of treatment. And I'm sure in those times, they really didn't have anything for treatment. And treatment for sex offenders runs at various different levels, and there are some things that predict some fairly good things, and if it's important, I'll talk a bit about that. But you really have to have a lot of information about that. And then I wonder about the folks that in those times were lepers, and I wonder about the folks that said, and you have to live off in this corner, which I understood, because you might make me ill. I wonder what that did to the insides of the people that made them do that. So it's really, really complex problem. The question I have here is, can a leper or a diabetic or a child molester be a Christian? Now, obviously, I've set you up there because, of course, yes to two and no to one. I mean, but that's really part of the issue. And what that presupposes is that you have to accept the idea that being a child molester is a disease syndrome. It's not just somebody that says, oh, I'm a dirty, mean, nasty person, and this is what I want to do just because I'm a dirty, mean, nasty person. Now, I work with some dirty, mean, nasty persons not very long, and I think dirty, mean, nasty persons ought to be in prison. I don't have any problem with that. You know, but there are some discriminations of folks that we can, at least from a psychological standpoint, what is dirty, mean, nasty, or how dirty, mean, and nasty do you have to be? I belong to a national organization which the leader of that made a pretty controversial statement, which he said, if you took all child molesters and put them in 3 categories, he said, the bottom third, there's probably not anything we know what to do about anyway. So you probably either decide whether you believe in the death penalty or lock them up for the rest of their life, because we don't know what to do. You know, we do know that a percentage of people that molest kids, after they get out of prison, they're going to go back to molesting kids. And what we know about treatment today is we don't know how to stop that. So his argument was, and about the top third, if you catch them, and I have enough experience in this field to know that there's a certain amount of truth in this, the top third, and if they spend a little bit of jail time, because usually if you catch a child molester very early, whether it's right, wrong, or different, the sentencing is often a misdemeanor, gets pled down to a misdemeanor, and so they're going to spend a year or two in jail. And statistically, they don't reoffend very high. Now, if your daughter or granddaughter is one that do reoffend, that's way too many. I'm not arguing that. But statistically, their rate of reoffense is not real high. Boy, it's that middle third that you can really do some good with if you carefully discriminate. you do, like we in our state, and the same concept is true in all states, but in our state, there are classifications made by the corrections officer, the Department of Corrections, and psychologists, and you get together and you do assessment. I do a lot of forensic evaluations and write up this big honking long report about 50 pages in which we make a decision. Do we think that person is treatable? And do we think that person can be in the community while they're being treated? In most cases in our state, and it differs in some states, in Arizona you're on supervision for life, period. I mean, you just are. In our state, you usually get 8 years for a first-time child offense. And if you seem to be treatable and amenable, then what you get is an 8-year sentence, which they commute 5 years of it and have you go to 3 years of counseling. But a lot of the guys don't finish, or women, we have some women too, and a lot of them don't finish in 3 years. But you're allowed to roll out over to the fourth year, and the fifth year, and the sixth year, and the seventh year, and the eighth year, until you, it seems like you can believe they've made the changes they need to make. Crucial thing that I'm sort of aiming at here is that there are differences in child molesters. And the level three folks are really pretty scary, violent, predatory. They're the people that knock people in the head and pull them in bushes, whether it's kids or otherwise. And there's nobody that can sit and tell you that we know collectively what to do with those folks. We don't know how to make the community safe. We just don't know how to do it. The level two folks are in-betweeners. The lines are mushy as to how you get to be a level two, unless you're a community caretaker. Now, if you have a level one offense, which means it's more likely, and I'm sure this is both offensive and surprising to some of you, the easiest child molesters to treat are the ones that have intrafamilial offenses. If it's your stepdaughter, and it's the only victim, and she's in the family, and it's no violence, and it's grooming, and it's taken 6 months or a year to get the whole pattern set to cross some kind of a sexual boundary, we have pretty good success with that. Although I do an evaluation, and about 20% of the people that I evaluate, I say no, they're not safe in the community. And the attorneys in the King County area know that at our shop, it's not a pay your fee and get your B. You don't get in easy. So they self-select a lot of the guys. They never even get to evaluate. So the ones that come into our treatment program are pretty well set for success. But I have to tell you that all it takes is one community outcry of somebody who's violent or predatory, like you've had over in the Coeur d'Alene area, or you know, some instances lately that have been so heinous and horrific, and everybody says, oh, they're all the same. And do you have any idea? We can't take in the state of Washington 18,000 more guys in prison. Prisons are too full as it is. We can't, there's no room. So we have to do a better job of discriminating, and we have to do a better job of treatment. Yes, ma'am?
Well, in Minneapolis, or in Minnesota, we're building a whole other facility because our facilities are full, and we have this program where once they've served their time, then they go to these, it used to be like state hospitals and so corrections, and they can be there indefinitely.
They have that in Washington also. They have one facility that if they're level threes, which means they don't get to be in the community treatment, and if they're in the prison and they judge them during their prison time that they're incorrigible, then they go down to McNeil Island at our place, and then they're on an indeterminate sentence, and that gets difficult because a lot of attorneys will get involved in that and say how unfair that is, and you know, it's really, really complex. Fortunately, the most of the people that are in this 10% that cross sexual lines, ministers, we work with a lot of ministers. The word gets out that I'm a Christian, and we'll get a disproportionate, and I used to be a school psychologist, so we'll get a fair amount of school teachers and ministers who have molested kids. And, boy, knock on wood, I've been doing this about 25 years, and I don't know, now, the minute I say this, I'm going to tell you why the statistic doesn't mean anything. I don't know of anybody that's gone through our program and completed it that has reoffended. But I don't know if somebody moved to Louisiana and got arrested. I don't know that. And I know guys that, oops, that's right, Richard, he didn't, but he was getting close. There was one minister that he started getting back into an offense pattern, and he got himself in trouble, and he happened to be a minister. But generally speaking, we have some pretty good success with that. Now, let me ask you, after having set you all up where it's not okay to say whatever you want to say, when we talk about child molesters, what do you think of? What terms, what expressions, what feelings, what comes up for you when I say child molesters? Yes, sir.
I guess what I think of it is the scary thing is that you can't look at someone and say, well, they're probably a child molester. But they don't. I don't.
Not visible.
I don't
see a lack of awareness.
But they don't look like any different than
anybody. Right. They don't look like any different than anybody else.
Especially when, you know, when this, all this furor in Spokane, they start bringing out these numbers of how many are in Spokane and that. And then you think, okay, you can tell your kids, you can talk to the kids at school and that, but sometimes they're the nicest people around.
So
they've got these skills honed down, and they're good at it, and it's just so scary because it's so hard to fight.
So it's a lack of awareness and scary are two things that really come up for you. Yeah, I'll join that club.
One of the things that I think of is power and innocence. One person has the power, one of them is innocent, and could we change them perhaps for the rest of their lives by that incident or incidents? Abuse and that journey, that person is forever affected. I was in the fifth steps, the addictions unit, in the 12 step program, the fifth step is like a confessional. And, you know, that's the hardest for me to hear, but how often there is, that is part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Either they have been molested or have been the molester. And the pain of that story and that scar affects them forever. That's a long answer,
but
you didn't say it to be short.
I didn't say that to be short. Not at all. But it started with power and innocence, and of course, all sex abuse is power abuse. It's always, I have more power, and I use that power. And whether it's a teacher and a student, or a stepdad and a daughter, a stepdaughter, or a daughter, you know, it's all a power position, which comes back to the thing you said, the honing of the skills to. And it's really scary. It is really, really scary. And you can't tell. How about anybody else? What comes up for you?
Well, I think
go ahead.
No, I was just thinking that the bushes, somebody jumping out, you know, that sort of thing comes up with child molesters.
The violent, predatory, scary.
Right.
Oh! Yeah, right.
I don't think of the guy in the bushes. I think of again, the guy you would never think would do it. And then how, historically anyway, maybe we're getting better at this now, we want to keep that quiet for the sake of the victim and for the sake of the perpetrator. And the example I'm thinking of would be a pastor in our church a long time ago, got somehow involved with a teenager. And the guy was gone, but nobody knew why. And my imagination created a much worse scene, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering, I guess what comes to my mind, how we've handled it, how bad is it, a confusion over the whole.
And perhaps by not talking about it, who else then becomes victim, because the situation is glossed over.
Yeah, the guy was just gone, and nobody talked a word about it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
May I ask a question that's kind of off your question? Just to clarify something for you. Mm-hmm. You talk about different levels, and I don't know if Idaho has a different situation, but when I read in the newspapers, it seems like some 19-year-old fellows whose 17-year-old girlfriend's parents called the police is now a sex offender. Mm-hmm. And this is just, I thought this stuff just happened actually with teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, so that now it's just a kid labeled for life as a sex offender.
Yeah.
Because he picked a girlfriend that was a year too young.
And you know, I wish I could tell you why. I know that's happening, and we've talked about it in our practice 10 years ago or some period of time, make up a period of time. We didn't get them, but we have a group, what we got, about 10 of them now? That I call them 20-somethings because that was and it's made up mostly of guys who are 20, 22, 23, come on in, 25 years old, and they have had sexual contact with somebody, 14, 15, 16, one of our psychologists calls them the Y&D group, the young and dumb group. They're not sexually deviant. And, you know, when I was in high school, my coaches just, the numbers were wrong, but we used to always hear, 17 will get you 20. I mean, boy, you mess around with anybody 17 years old, you're going to jail. And we now have about 10 of these guys that are getting arrested, and we didn't used to have them. And they are getting, and they get labeled as sex offenders. We were at a statewide conference, Bree and I, recently, where they made a presentation about the fact that we've got to have a whole new section of treatment because they're not. They need boundary issue training. They need issues around morals and values. They got to learn what's up. But they are. In our state, they will be registered as sex offenders. And it's it's a shame, but it is what it is.
No, I didn't want to get off the topic. I was just curious whether that was just Idaho.
And like I said, we've got a group now. We've got our 20-something group or our young and dumb group, and that's what we're having to work with because we didn't used to get those. They would plea bargain it down, or they would tell them to go join the Army, or they used to do things differently with them, and I don't know what that dynamic's about, but we're experiencing that.
There's a woman, a social worker that works with a group of teenage moms in our community, where church is, and most of these gals are 15 and 16, and most of the fathers are over 18.
Right. I want to make sure that I stress something when I was talking about the levels 1, 2, and 3, that at least in our state, in Washington state, if you are a community caretaker, you're automatically a level 2. If you're a Sunday school teacher, if you're a anybody, if you're a nurse, if you're a school teacher, if you're anybody that's a community caretaker, you're automatically a level 2. Now what that means for you is that they have the right now to put your picture on the wall, to notify the schools, to put pictures up on the billboards all around in Washington. Level 1s, they don't do that, and they are not allowed to do that. But level 3s, they do, and they make Amber Alerts and they do all that. But if you're a community caretaker, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong, I'm just saying that's the way it is, that if you're in that role, and they've now passed another law, just passed it, this legislature in our state, that if you're a community caretaker and it's a sex offense with someone you do not know, it's a 25-year automatic sentence. 25 years. If it's the first offense and you don't know the child, and that's part of this crazy thing, if you know the child, then you probably are more gentle, more groomy, not somebody jumping out of the bushes. You're probably also more amenable to treatment.
But what's the difference in the crime rate? I mean,
from the victim standpoint?
Yeah, from the victim. There's, I mean, it's the same effect in their life, right?
Yeah, right. So it's a crazy system.
If you pick somebody, you know, I think it's scary.
A talk we went to by a woman in Oregon, her name is Jan Hyman, and she has a lot of experience working with offenders and victims. And I remember she started her talk with, when a child comes into her office the first time, she's looking at the intake. One of the things that she hopes for is that it was violent, it was predatory, it was outrageous, because it's so much easier to work with children in helping them understand that this was not their fault, that this was truly a crime, a violation of something precious and sacred that should never have happened. When it happens incestually in families, it's very, very psychologically damaging, because the very people that they should trust are behaving in ways that are so untrustworthy that they can't sort it out, so they take responsibility. And so the damage is very insidious when it's incestuous, as opposed to, you know, if someone grabs you and does something horrible to you, you can go, that's the bad guy over there. Mm-hmm. I don't have a relationship with him. I can discriminate and know that I'm not responsible for that behavior. So she says it's much easier to work with children who have experienced a predatory crime as opposed to an incestuous crime. Which is interesting, because from the legal standpoint, they're letting the incestuous offenders have a much easier bargaining position in the legal system than someone who's violent and predatory, because obviously I understand that in terms of community safety. If you're walking down the street, you're at much higher risk from somebody out there on the street who is violent and predatory. You're not going to walk into somebody's living room where there's an incest father that's offending his daughter and be at risk to be offended yourself, because the pattern is so different around incest abuse. It takes a long time to groom and set the pattern up. So you're not going to find yourself being assaulted in that scenario, as opposed to walking down an alley, the predatory guy could jump out and assault you. So obviously we need to protect ourselves from that at a different level. But in terms of the impact on the victim, it's worse for the kid and the family.
So is it, but like now you're saying that things have changed a lot, and so people, it seems like there's much more awareness. Actually, people are being prosecuted and all that. So are they finding that it's better for the kids who have been abused? The younger they're able to have intervention and then treatment for themselves, is it better the younger or the sooner you can... help for them?
Right. What the research has shown is that the greatest damage to a child is whether or not they're believed. And we have a whole population of women who are adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse who, in their own naive attempts to get authority figures to talk to and be heard, this is 20, 30 years ago, and were very ineffectual, were far more damaged by the fact that they went to mommy and said, please don't leave me at home alone with stepdaddy. I'm scared. Please don't leave me alone. And mommy's like, you know, listen, I gotta go to work, honey. You know, whatever's going on, we'll talk about it later. And meanwhile, this child's being abused. Now, from the child's perspective, they think they just told mom what was going on. And mom didn't hear it. Mom wasn't attending. Mom wasn't picking up on the cues. Mom wasn't sophisticated enough, or in her own denial, didn't want to believe that this was something that her partner would be capable of. And so today, what kids are finding is that they're being encouraged and supported in every system imaginable, whether it's a church community or a school environment, or even being taught by their parents to come and tell us if something is happening to you, that there's no touch areas where your bathing suit covers, and that we will believe you, we will support you. So kids are very much more outspoken and very ready to report, which is part of the healing process, is to be able to go and say, I don't like what's happening to me, and have an adult go, well, we're going to make that stop.
10 years ago, or 15 years ago, in King County Prosecutor's Office, Sexual Assault Center, and we got this from a very official statistical situation. We were at a Christmas party, talking to the woman that does all the intakes, and she was saying, you know, it's really crazy. She said 10, 15 years ago when she was doing that job, every offender that came in, whatever number of offenses they had, she'd say, multiply it by 10. Today, because there's so much more on TV, because, and in some ways it seems worse, but in that sense, not for an individual child, But across the board, it's so much better because so many more people now get stopped the first time. So many more people, the offense has only happened not for as long to that particular child. We have a counselor who was a wonderful elementary school counselor, and he was giving his Duso the dolphin, and he would talk to the kids about safe touch and all that kind of stuff. He went out in the hallway and he said, now, if any of you children want to talk about this further, you know, thinking that he gets some reports, which he always did at these elementary schools, come on out in the hall and you can talk to me and his kid raised. Mr. Carlson, I'm not going in the hallway with you all by yourself. So he said, way to go. Good job. It is better. And I know it doesn't seem better, but it is lots better. But it's always that fear thing that we hear. You know, you think about child molesters and we think about a particular person that we care about. I mean, and I'm not saying this to elicit sympathy, but I've been spit on in court. I've been yelled at. When I go into court and say that I think it's someone is amenable for treatment, the person that they molested and their family think I'm the devil incarnate because I can't take away what happened to them. All I can do is make some kind of a judgment. Then we get to the thing that is the theme of what our workshop or our week is here. Is it possible that that person can be reclaimed in any way? Is it possible that they can be brought out of the place where we stick the lepers? Is there any way we ever bring those people back into society, back into our family, back into... And that just creates tremendous dissonance for me. I work in a situation, I've not had anyone in my family that I know of molest somebody. But I was on a television show, and I don't even know if Laura knows this, but this guy asked me, Ken Schramm is a guy in our area, and he does this thing, and I've been on there twice. He asked me to come in, I'm not doing it again. He sets me up. But he asked me, he says, he comes right out of a break, and he says, well, I want to know, if your daughter was raped by so-and-so, what would you do? I said, I'd probably shoot the guy. Well, you're supposed to be a therapist. No, you didn't ask me what I do professionally. If some guy rapes my daughter, I don't know what I'd do. I'd like to say I'd be full of grace and forgiveness, but I might get a .38 Smith & Wesson. I don't know what I'd do. But see, that's my own internal stuff that I've got to live with, and I haven't had to have to deal with that personally, but I deal with it societally, and I would say there's a whole lot going on. It is a whole lot better. It's way better than it used to be, both in terms of treatment. Yes, Paul?
No, go ahead, finish.
Now I'm...
The last question, sorry. Who are the reporters now? I mean, you say that kids are more willing to report. Do spouses, partners report? I mean, is that changed?
Well, what's interesting, and that's a great question, is like I set you up because that's the next part of my little thing here. I
totally agree with that.
Not that the names matter. A guy named Hank Girardo started a program which wound up being all the Safe Touch programs and all the kind of programs that have been proliferated in the churches and in the schools for years. The problem is that we're learning now they don't particularly work. It's better than it used to be. But kids do not, and we know this now, and for a lot of years we didn't, but now, and I'm going to answer your question in a second, but the shift is to move away from helping the kids learn to report for themselves and to educate parents to be more alert and watch for things, because with a really smart groomer, a kid is going to get conned. And tomorrow I'll talk some about things that child molesters have told us, but I'll tell you this much. Any child molester can do one of two things. He can either con any six-year-old into darn near what he wants, or he'll quit immediately and go find another one that's vulnerable. So putting a lot of our energy, which we did for years and years, and all of our curriculum into, say, let's get our kids where they can just tell. And some of that does happen. You know, if you have a really good relationship with your kids, and they will come and talk to you, that's really the best kind of thing. But if they're conned into thinking, and this is classic, we'll be in trouble if you tell, then they don't tell. Mm-hmm. So the parents have to pay attention. And the awful thing, I learned this years ago, and I hate learning things like this. I just hate it. You never let a 15-year-old boy babysit somebody who's young enough that they wouldn't be able to tell. You just don't do it. Because 15-year-old boys are all on drugs. The hormones are running through their system. They're sexually excitable like that. And they can be the greatest kids in the world, but they want to see something or they want to touch something. Well, see, I wish that weren't true. But it is true. You also don't leave the keys to your car out in the middle of the city in Spokane. I hope you don't do that, because somebody's liable to steal it. So there are parts of our life that there's an innocence that we just can't have. I know when we were first coming up here and Laura was, pretty young, Bree said Holden was the first place that she felt really safe to let Laura take off in the morning and I'll see you at 10 o'clock at night. We don't feel safe like that in Seattle. We just don't. But here, now maybe you can't even do it here. I hope that doesn't happen, but you know what I mean? You've just got to be paying attention, and when kids are beginning to do the things that we have to watch for, they're starting to have nightmares, if they're young enough, they go back to not being potty trained again, and you have to listen to what they're saying between the lines, because they can't tell you clearly. But the shift has been now to educate more with adults to pay attention as to what could be going on. But kids are reporting more, adults are reporting more, spouses are reporting more. But here's another, there's more questions here than there are answers. Understand, and I want to go back to what Bree said, when kids report sexual abuse, at the Harborview Sexual Assault Center with Lucy Berliner, who's really an international figure on that, she will say that 94-95% of the kids that report sexual abuse, it's true, it happened. This gets complicated. When there's a divorce involved, that 94% drops to 50%. So there's parent alienation, sometimes one of the parents will say, because whatever their own issues are, well, he molested our daughter. So then it really gets complicated. I hate those. I'm doing one of those evals right now. They're so complex because now you have to really sort some things out that you don't. But if it's simply a child is giving you some information, you're seeing redness where you don't think there ought to be redness. You're hearing things, I don't want to go stay with dad. Kids don't lie about those kinds of things. The other thing you look for is inappropriate comments, age-inappropriate comments. Kids don't talk sexually unless beyond their ages. And there are lots of books that will give you indications of what's the normal age range for what 4-year-olds say and what 6-year-olds say and what 8-year-olds say. And there's just all kinds of language that doesn't come out of a child that hasn't been molested. Now this gets tricky because is it by Uncle Charlie? Is it by somebody down the block? But I think you got to put everybody on notice. You got to say something's going on here, and you got to believe your kid. And I really want to reinforce what Bree said. The kids, the biggest trauma for children in child sexual abuse is not being believed. That's the biggest one. Because see, for a kid, one or two things has to happen. My caretaker is okay, and I'm okay. But if there's sexual stuff going on, either they're out of bounds, or I'm out of bounds, and I can't afford for them to be out of bounds, because that's who takes care of me. So I must be crazy. I must be weird. This must be okay. And it's just so difficult for children. But it's better. It's way better than it used to be. I want to take just a minute, though, to ask just about this thing of what does it do for you when, hopefully, I'm not being a child molester apologetic, but I am raising questions like making statements, a diabetic or a child molester, can they be a Christian? And what does it do for you inside when you try to put those two together? It creates all kinds of tension for me, and I'm not going to resolve it today, but I think that's something we have to look at. And if you'd say something to me just about that, don't let me hang here. I'm going to get...
Yeah, it creates tension for me because North Idaho tends to be pretty vigilante in a lot of areas.
Right, sure.
Just because of the makeup of North Idaho.
Sure.
And so it does bother me when I, you know, see these comments in the newspaper, letters to the editor, but it's really... really vindictive. I think, yeah, those people are doing really bad things, but it's like they don't have a right to live as far as other people. So that's kind of the tension for me.
Sure.
Where does the being a vigilante start and how it begins? But it's not just child molesters.
Mm-hmm.
Politics and everything.
Sure. To confound it a little bit, we have been working with a young man, and I think it's, I think it's a shame that he's in prison. He's in prison now for 7 years. He was a youth pastor at a church, 22 years old, one of these bright kids that... finished high school and running start, that's a thing where by the time he finished high school, he had a community college degree finished, and he didn't quite fit into the regular high school thing. Very conservative Christian kid. And how does anyone know? I have a hard enough time judging my own faith, sometimes I'm not going to say the judgment of yours, but I thought he was very sincere about that. And here's an interesting problem this young man had. In his church, it was absolutely adamant that you would not have any kind of sexual contact with yourself or anybody else. So there was no masturbation and there was no sexual contact with anybody. So this young man was just walking around wrapped up.
Outside of marriage.
Sorry, he was single. Yeah, he could do it if he got married. But he didn't want to get married. He was trying to get his business going. He was a home remodeler and made some money and he did well. But... So he was wrapped up pretty tightly. And what he did then was start looking at some internet pornography. Not kids, but he started, and he got really compulsive around internet pornography. So he'd go through a binge purge thing. I won't do anything. And then he'd look at internet pornography and masturbate. I won't do anything. At the same time, he was being the youth pastor. Very successful, charismatic, just a neat young man. I liked him a lot. So he got one of these telephone calls from a 14-year-old girl in his congregation, in his youth group. Now, this is what we call it young and dumb. She said, I want to sneak out of the house and I want to meet you because I want to talk or something. How silly. I'll meet you at 11:30 at night. And he said, yes. So they get in the back seat of his car and she takes her blouse off and he touches her. And he is so wrapped up, he's ready to go, and he said, I want to have intercourse, and she said no, and he said, okay. So he touched her left breast with his right hand for about 10, 15 seconds. Then the same thing happened like 3 months later, and he was just guilt-ridden, and he went to this pastor, and he turned himself in, and of course they immediately said, you can't be the youth pastor anymore, and I understand that, you can't do that. And his pastor said, I have to report to the police, and he said, I know that, but I wanted to do it through you. I wanted to be a straight-up guy. So he got one of these SOSA things where he's now in treatment with us. He went to jail for a month and he came in treatment with us. And he looked at pornography. While he was in treatment, which is not okay with us. We work at it, but we've only had him now for a couple of months. And it may take us a year to get that pornography addiction knocked down where he can work with it. So then he... So we reported it because we've worked closely with the Department of Corrections and said it's not a revocable offense. But and they did a second time about a month later. they put him in prison for 7 years. I'm sad about that. He is a person who I think we could reconcile his faith and his sexual compulsivity, and in no way, and I guess here you'd have to just accept that hebephile is a term that pedophile is somebody that's sexually attracted to little kids, like 5, 6 and under. A hebephile is somebody that's attracted to kids prepubescent, 14, 15, 13, mm-hmm. girls in that age. He was not that. This was a guy that was trying to run his program so tight with abstinence, and he was just like a rubber band that was stretched out to here. And I don't have an answer for that, but I think we could have worked with that and gotten it through. And he started another church, Mars Hill Church in Seattle, and was going to that church and had a 23-year-old girlfriend. And right, wrong, or indifferent, they made the decision to be sexual, and they were going to get married, but that seemed to be working for him. Until he looked at pornography again because they quit being sexual. Now, that's complex, I know. What do you do with all that? I am saying that my heart went out to him because I believe he could be a child molester, a guy who touched... Well, he did that twice with two different 14-year-olds. Those girls, I think we could have been successful with him. And I don't have any question about his faith. But boy, doesn't that create some... complex kinds of issues.
So he doesn't get treatment then?
No.
He goes to prison for 7 years.
Prison for 7 years.
And then
years.
That's it. He doesn't get treatment.
No.
When he comes out, we don't know what his sentence is going to be when he comes out, because we do get guys out of prison that need treatment and are forwarded to our facility for treatment.
Okay.
So maybe.
But is that usually the higher offense guys?
No, it's the lower offense guys. Yeah, we don't deal with any level 3 offenders.
No, and he won't get treatment in prison because in our state, what they do, you know, politics gets interested. And I really understand this. We've only got 200 beds at Monroe, which is a place where they have 200 beds for sex offense treatment in prison. And they've got like 500 people waiting in line to get in there. So they take the worst of the worst. The violent, predatory guys who statistics say it's probably not a lot we can do with anyone. So this guy will never get treatment because he's not bad enough. And he teased with me. He said, well, not teased. He's a bright young man. He said, well, maybe if I go shoot somebody, I had that plus that then I could get treatment because then I'd be bad enough. And it's really complex.
Well, I was going to ask, so... there are obviously, I mean, we're learning so many people have been sexually abused, sexually molested, whatever. Mm-hmm. A lot of people as children, sometimes as adults. But not all of them go on to sexually abuse other people.
No.
Most do not.
Most do not.
So what is, do you know what the difference is? Like what triggers that in people? Is there, I mean, any ideas?
Do you have some ideas?
Well, I'll let you go, because then we're going to wrap this up.
Well, I think that, you know, you would need to speak to the whole template, arousal template, and that sort of thing, to answer that adequately. Which I think is fascinating. It's a fascinating question. I'd love to hear you talk about it.
I feel like I'm on a television show, and Ken Shrim said, and I want you to give an hour-long answer in 2 minutes. We know that when we are all young, when we're young, we all go through a period of paraphilia. Paraphilia is a term, like pedophilia is a subset under paraphilia. And it means we all go through a period of exhibitionism, and we go through a period of homosexual behavior. And we usually get through this by the time we're 6. And it's a little, you show me yours and I'll show you mine. And most of us don't get fixated there. And we just get on through that stuff. But it's pretty natural, kind of, oh, and your mommy catches you. You're not supposed to do that. And you stop. And most folks get on through that. Some folks, John Money is the guy that has done most of the research on this, and he talks about it like, if you're going from Seattle to Spokane, there's a pretty straight road. Some folks get on a detour, and the detour is where you get these arousal templates, and something happened, and the biggest thing that happens with an intensity of arousal is when you're in some of these developmental stages. You hit them about 5 or 6, then you hit it again at about 12 or 13, and the third time you hit it is about 20 or 22, and the fourth time is around 40. They get less and less, or you really get your wiring kind of messed up. I mean, and if you get off track, like in a detour over here, and here's what's interesting, and it happens so often. If it's intense what happened, and it's what's more intense than shaming, you then can maybe get only or a partial sexual arousal from repeating that experience. Mm-hmm. And that happens to many people. So the most extreme example Money ever gave to us when I sat in some lectures of his, it's one of the more bizarre, but maybe that points it out, examples of that kind of behavior. There are some people, it's really a tiny percentage, that the only way they can have sexual arousal is when they're close to being asphyxiated. So they'll go, and what's odd is they have to be shamed in that too. So they'll find them in public restrooms with a bag around their head, and they suffocated because they took it a little too far. But the only way they can ejaculate, and they can't usually find people that will do that with them because it's too weird, is put a plastic bag over their head and come very, very close to asphyxiation and then masturbate to the point of ejaculation and hope you time it right where you get some breath again. Well, Money did, and he just gave an exact case history of one young man who, when he was 12 and he was just first starting to experience his own sexuality, whereas, you know, I told you the hormones were running and he was starting to get... He couldn't swim, and he was with a girlfriend who he had an enormous crush on, and he was beginning to have sexual thoughts and feelings toward her. He'd never done anything. And they were out in a boat, and she fell over and drowned. And he kept hanging onto the boat and trying to reach her as she'd go down and she drowned. And out of that, as weird as it sounds, his sexual feeling and his inability to get his breath paired up so that as a 25-year-old, the only way he could have any kind of sexual arousal was this detour. Hmm. Now, multiply that by a lot of other detours that a lot of the rest of us have. So, Patrick Carnes, who wrote that book and has written a lot on sexual compulsivity, talked about when his mother walked into the room where he was upstairs, and he was about 13 and he was masturbating, and he said, but she went over to the door and she said, "Wilbur! We failed! He's doing it!" Well, he didn't feel very good about that. He was a staunch Catholic. Carnes said that he had to wear the little beads because he was supposed to be doing his beads during the day. I mean, you know, he was really, really in trouble. He was shamed about that activity. So then sometimes when you're shamed about it, that's a highly intense activity. And so what happens is you pair that activity with your sexual, like, you know, you get all these crazy stories. I'm working with a guy now that the only way he can be sexual is with someone that he doesn't know very well. With his partner, they haven't had sex for about 12 years because he can't maintain an erection, but he can go to a prostitute and have sex. But see, he's got some things, although he got into it. Well, when he was 14 years old, on his paper route, a woman took him in and... are we in your workshop?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll stop. I'll finish this couple sentences.
Sure, go ahead.
It's juicy.
You want to be at the right time.
He's on his paper route, and this 35-year-old woman wanted to be sexual with him. And he began an odyssey for the next 5 years of being way disproportionate, other 14, 15-year-old boys were talking about things, and he was experiencing things. It took me 3 months to convince him that he'd been sexually assaulted. Mm-hmm. He had no idea. He said, I thought I was king of the hill. Mm-hmm. I mean, every boy thought I was the greatest thing. And I said, and what cost have you ever had? He said, because I can't be sexual with the woman I love. And he said, I will do anything to be able to do that. So, and we're working on it. We're succeeding, and it's weird, and we'll tell you about that some other day. But we're really getting there, and we got to quit. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. So,